The following podcast contains strong language and frank conversations about topics that some listeners may find upsetting.
But he was there with his mum. And then she asked the question, actually, could his children be born with HIV? And he didn't require me to answer. He said, "Mum, this isn't a genetic disorder. This is not, you know, this is not a recessive trait you passed on." He'd obviously just done in biology, and he gave a fantastic as to why he, living with HIV on suppressive treatment, would not pass it on to his children.
Welcome to Positive Advice, the podcast all about exploring what it means to be living with HIV as a young person and giving those people a voice to shape their future. I'm Eli Fitzgerald, your host for this series. In this episode of the podcast, we're exploring the world of healthcare, environment and treatment to find out what the experts can learn from those receiving the care on offer. As always, I'm joined by one of the leaders in their field as we try and improve the lives of young people with HIV. This time I'm joined by Dr. Caroline Foster, a specialist in adolescent HIV care from St. Mary's Hospital in London. Welcome to the show, Caroline. Can you tell us a little bit about your work within HIV care?
Well, thanks, Eli, and thanks very much for having me along today. I first started in HIV care as a specialist looking after babies and children about 25 years ago. So these were babies born with HIV, and we didn't really have treatment. But over the years, treatment has improved. So many of these babies that I first met 20 years ago have now been through their teenage years and are young adults. And whilst we looked after them in paediatrics, and that all went really well, we'd see babies, children, their mums and dads. Suddenly we had 16, 17-year-olds. And we were looking at transitioning towards adult care. And they really didn't want to leave paediatrics. Their parents were really nervous about them moving into adult care. And so were we. And the first four or five young people who went to our really lovely supportive adult service found it really difficult to engage with healthcare professionals they didn't know. They felt it really difficult to sit in a waiting room of a sexual health clinic when many of them had never had sex themselves. They felt judged by the other patients in the room who they felt were looking at them going, "You're only 17, 18. How come you've already got HIV?" Not knowing that they were born with it. So we very quickly realised that we needed to change the way we provided care. And that's how we set up the 900 Clinic, which is a dedicated service for young people who've grown up with HIV, who are moving from paediatric into adult care. And it is a very holistic joint service between adolescent healthcare providers like myself, like the wonderful clinical nurse specialists I work with, but also the adult healthcare providers. So Sarah Fidler, who's our adult doctor, Sarah Ayres, who's our adult nurse. We have adult psychology. And it's a very multidisciplinary setup, really, to try and address the holistic needs of young people.
Amazing. And you mentioned a bit in there about sort of unique challenges that were faced that you've seen of people growing up living with HIV. Could you expand a little bit more on some of these unique challenges you've noticed?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good question. And I don't think the unique challenges faced by young people accessing healthcare are limited to those living with HIV. I think I also look after young asylum seeking children. I look after young children and teenagers living with hepatitis B and C. And whilst the stigma we see around HIV is in some ways different, actually there are lots of cross-cultural reference points with other chronic diseases of childhood, particularly other blood-borne viruses, and particularly for migrants coming into the country. So I think we look at it as it's that crucial age between, I would say, 14 and 24, where you're not a child, but you're not an adult. And actually, that really fits the behavioural patterns that we see during that period, which is such an exciting time. I mean, adolescence is fantastic and absolutely terrifying. And what I, you know, find very strange about adults who work in the adult world is they seem to forget that they must have been an adolescent. You know, there's an enormous amount of brain development in the first couple of years of life when you're a baby. You know, you go from being able to do nothing, just lying there, to be able to walk and talk. But also in adolescence, we see a similar level of brain activity, of rewiring, of pruning, of adapting, of learnt experience, of the thalamic drive that makes us want to get out there and do maybe crazy risk-taking things. But you sort of needed to, evolutionary. You needed to do those crazy risk-taking things. Otherwise, you'd have never left your mother's hut. You know, I always say when I'm trying to explain to what I would say adult healthcare professionals who seem not to get what it's like to be a young person is, remember your first kiss. Remember the first time you had sex. And imagine doing that first and every then lived experience with a sexually transmissible disease before you yourself have ever had sex. And that doesn't matter whether you're living with HIV or living with hepatitis B. You know, try and have some understanding.
Also here with us is Amanda Ely from Cheever. Welcome back. So I'm going to ask you the same sort of question around what you've noticed the unique challenges faced by adolescents and young people growing up with HIV are.
I think through our work, you know, one of the themes that comes through so powerfully from the time that we spend with young people growing up with HIV is how difficult it can be at that stage in your life, in particular when you feel like you're different from your peers, when you feel like a part of your life is something you have been told you have to hide, and therefore it's a part of yourself that you're hiding. And I think that that's particularly difficult when you are at a stage in your childhood moving into adulthood where you're really forming a stronger sense of who you are. Your identity is really becoming your own at that stage. You're less about, you know, your family when you move into adolescence. You're much more about who am I? What does it mean to be me? And when there's a part of you that you've been told forever, you've got to hide, don't talk about this, don't share this in your peer group. And when your peer group might be becoming the most important thing to you often, but you're not quite accepted there because you're hiding something that, you know, we may all say it's just a virus, you know, it's fully treatable now. But actually, when you've always lived with that virus, and in quite a confusing way, if you were a younger child and you didn't actually know, you know, the name of your health condition, you didn't know why you were taking medicines, etc. Accepting that, coming to terms with living with HIV, and at the moment we expect this to be a lifelong experience, whilst wanting to be fully accepted in your peer group, developing a strong sort of sense of who you are as an individual, I think it all becomes quite complicated. Something that comes through very powerfully when we do a lot of work with young people in group settings, maybe in residentials that we do a lot of, is when young people will use the words, you know, I finally felt able to be myself here. I finally felt accepted. I'm able to be open for the first time in my life because they're with young people who share the experience.
This episode is all about looking at the structural healthcare issues young people living with HIV encounter, from healthcare and treatment to the places they grew up in. We spoke to Agnes at the 24th International AIDS Conference in Montreal about what life was like for her growing up in Nigeria.
Should I say it's a really sunny place and it's hot there. It's like a ghetto. Yeah, lots of rowdy things going on, a lot of most persons like low income persons reside there, but it's fun because you get to meet, you get to make friends, play different games. So generally, some persons they are really cool, while others are a lot troublesome. Yeah, so. That's it.
What kind of trouble?
Quarrels, fights. So some persons get drunk and they misbehave, like they act up. You get to find young persons there who inject drugs, who takes really strong drugs, and it gets them intoxicated and They act up, yeah.
In that clip, we sort of heard this conversation around Agnes's environment and what she sort of describes as a sort of stressful environment with a lot of open drug use, fights, as she said, and it doesn't necessarily feel like it could be good in terms of accessing healthcare. So my question to you, Caroline, would be, how important is your environment when considering healthcare?
I mean, I think that's a great question. I mean, I think your environment is incredibly important, and it has to be taken in context to you at a point in time. And one of the things we know is that life changes so extraordinarily between the years of 14 to 24. It's the first time you leave home. It's the, you know, the first time you may go away to university and to college. And you have to negotiate that environment. And I think one of the things we really feel is important about our young person service is removing the physical barriers to care, that recognizing that people often, you know, whether you're in Nigeria or in London, you may well not have the funds to afford the bus fare or the tube fare to get to your appointment. There may be other priorities that are conflicting. You may be looking after younger siblings. You may be looking after a parent with healthcare needs. And therefore, the flexibility of open access services, removing those barriers to care. I mean, I can't change an appointment in the NHS system, even for my patients. OK, because you're on the phone for about 45 minutes. And if you're a young person who doesn't have credit, how on earth are you going to? And you've been out of care for 2 years and you decided this is a moment of change. You have a motivation for going to re-engage in care. And that's absolutely terrifying because you think somebody's going to, you know, have a really negative, you know, the receptionist is going to tell you off for not having been there for 2 years. They're going to refuse to see you or whatever. How do you negotiate that on the telephone when you don't have credit, when, you know, you really don't want to be there? So removing those physical and practical barriers to care, I think, works incredibly well for young people.
I completely agree. Sometimes we can, from our very privileged position of being in an extremely wealthy country, assume that we've got a job done, particularly if we hear about the really, really huge challenges that somebody like Agnes is facing, growing up with HIV in an environment which presents so many wider challenges. It's sort of quite hard to foresee how getting access to her HIV medicine even reaches the top of her list of things that she's able to do in any particular moment. But I think, you know, even here with all the fantastic resource that we have available, we know there are huge difficulties with young people accessing care that they find comfortable, that they can engage with in a way that makes them feel empowered in taking kind of ownership over their healthcare needs. And it's very, very dependent on where you are in the country as to what kind of care you get access to. And even a simple thing, like Caroline said, about making an appointment can be almost impossible. You know, I think that transition experience as well is critical, because very often, fortunately, in paediatric care, there has been some really, you know, good, strong kind of sustained relationships of support with key healthcare professionals throughout children's lives. Many children are really fortunate that they've had these relationships that have been sustained through their childhood. And then they move into something totally unknown and are expected to have acquired a heck of a lot of competency in navigating all of that, of understanding what it even means to be, you know, in a different clinic with whatever it's called, with whoever it is, and you might not even see the same person whenever you go. I mean, it's a lot to ask. And we're talking about lifelong engagement with clinical care here.
Agnes in that clip mentioned a bit about how she sort of struggles to access her hospital with it being 40 minutes away. And you obviously just mentioned access to appointments in clinic. What do you think, because obviously it's not online appointments, but what could support us in removing barriers to accessing just HIV services in general?
You know, personally, I think it's about choice. That, and at different times in your life and at different stages in your life, a different model of healthcare will suit. You know, we've got young people who go from university and they may travel for a year and, you know, we will do a remote consultation or they will pop back. You know, it works at those stages, but there are other times in your life when you really need to be able to access face-to-face care. And sometimes having a fresh start with a new healthcare provider can be a really refreshing thing for young people. So it's about flexibility. It's about taking away the rigid barriers to care that healthcare services put up. You know, sometimes you do think that healthcare services do not want to actually see any patients when you're trying to negotiate for a young person, say, to get them seen in another speciality. So I think barriers to care are not serving our patient populations well, particularly the most vulnerable.
I think that it comes back to what we understand health to be. and thereby what do we understand healthcare to need to provide? Because if we think of health in this context as just controlling HIV and making sure the prescriptions are working and great, we've got, you know, HIV under control, job done. If that's how we're going to understand health, then it's maybe a relatively straightforward problem. But if we're thinking actually health is much more than that, health means living well, it means living happily, it means, you know, achieving, it means having good mental health. If we think about health in a really much broader sense, then we're thinking about a very different kind of setup for healthcare. And we know in that understanding, we need to think about the kind of relationships that people have with their healthcare providers as being really key. And that's challenging because relationships don't get made in a 20-minute consultation. They get built over time. They involve trust. And I think one of the things Caroline pointed to that we know is one of the really big successes of the adolescent clinic where she works is that young people know they can go away for 2 years and walk back through the door and nobody's going to judge their absence, question why they haven't been coming. And it's that acceptance because there's a relationship of trust there that people will feel safe to return to. Sadly, you know, I do still hear quite a lot of stories of people being told off, you know, basically, of being reprimanded, of being told, you know, still to this day, you do know what's going to happen to you if you don't take your medicine. And this sort of, you know, if a young person's lived with HIV for 20-odd years, the chances are that, yes, they have probably heard once or twice along the way what happens when you don't take your medicine. I don't think this is news to anybody now.
We have this phrase, one pill once a day keeps the doctor away. But if you're not taking any pills, that's absolutely fine. Just come and see me and we can have a chat about it. You know, let's keep the conversation going. Because from my point of view, writing a prescription is the least rewarding part of my job. The rewarding part of my job is working with young people, having known them for 20 years and seeing them grow up and become, you know, they get through
parents.
That complicated, yeah, they get through
parents.
That complicated 14 to 24-year-old bit and things become right. Life gets easier. And then they become parents themselves. And then, you know, they will have a joke with me about, oh, my God, do you remember my 14-year-old self screaming and throwing something in your clinic room, throwing something at my dad and, you know, rushing out downstairs, which of course I do. And then they're parents themselves and they're going, oh, my goodness, what's going to happen? This lovely baby's going to become a teenager. Ah! But, you know, it's an incredibly rewarding part of the job and writing prescriptions is not.
I always find it very interesting from... like, obviously, I go to a young person's clinic and I hear my friends who don't, they just go to, you know, whatever clinic in the country, such different experiences. They're like, oh yeah, I don't even speak to a doctor. I just speak to a nurse for 10 minutes and get my meds and have a blood test. And I'm like, what do you mean? You're not hearing all the gossip, everything? You don't get a little, you know, update your doctor or your nurse on your entire life for like 20 minutes and then get poked a few times and leave. Mm. But I don't know. It's a nicer environment. Like I went to sort of an average adult clinic for maybe a year and a bit. And the doctor, she was lovely. But I genuinely felt like it was a conveyor belt. Like you come in. You check your name in, then you sit in the waiting room, in which I remember once seeing someone I knew from school and thinking to myself, looks like I've got chlamydia again, just in a, this is my excuse this time round. And then you'd have your appointment, get your bloods done, and then you'd just get on with your day. There was no necessary, like, any human interaction in it. It was... oh, you're taking your meds. Okay, great. And that was it. If you take your meds, they're happy. Whereas at the young person's clinic, it's nice. It's relaxed. There's no pressure. We have another clip now as we hear from Portia from the USA about her experience with medicine and treatment.
Antiretroviral therapy, like the life-saving HIV medication that we have now, wasn't available until 1996, which was 10 years after I was born. So I think I was on like a lot of clinical trials and AZT, which was even toxic on adults, let alone like kids. So I think I experienced a lot of reactions from some of the clinical trials. And then just when you're born with HIV, the vertical population, we call people who were born with HIV or who've been living with HIV since birth or early childhood, they're called verticals. We experience it a unique challenges in the fact that, you know, most of your developmental or brain development happens between the ages of 1 and 3. And when you're people who are born positive, they experience a lot of delays in that progression. So I feel like I am privileged in the sense that I don't think I was affected very badly, but I do know a lot of verticals who have speech impediments or language barriers because they didn't, you know, or motor development issues, like all sorts of things, like our immune systems didn't get to develop fully all the way, so our CD4 counts are much lower than like someone who wasn't born with HIV, something that was like stopping your, you know. So we're very immunosuppressed. So I got pneumonia. I used to get pneumonia a lot. I experienced different opportunistic infections as a child. And I don't, because the treatment wasn't available, that I don't typically experience now. Like I haven't gotten pneumonia in so long, but I used to get it often as a child. And I can't remember, I was a kid, so I can't remember all of the opportunistic infections I would get, but I know I experienced a lot more when I was younger than I do now. And I think it's because the medication, my T cells dropped below 200 when I was like maybe 5. So yeah, I've been living with AIDS for since I was 5. And then once the medication became available, I started to be able to build my immune system a little bit more, you know, and not be as sick.
So Portia highlighted quite a lot of sort of advancements in medication and issues that she had faced growing up, living with HIV before medication. So Caroline, I'm going to ask you about HIV treatments and how they've come a long way, and we know they've come a long way, but there's still some skepticism about taking new medications. So how can you, or how do you reassure young people that the treatment you're providing is safe and right and good for them?
If your mum or dad decline taking medicine, it's a bit like COVID vaccination. It's really hard for you as a young person to go, I'm going to go against all my family beliefs and I'm going to go and take it. That's a really tough thing. And we've certainly had young people who want to take medication, who've taken it home from clinic, whose parents have then thrown it away and they've had to come back. So, you know, what you see in the clinic room is just a tiny, tiny fraction. You know, if you think somebody comes to clinic for half an hour, 3 times a year or twice a year, you know, it's then the lived experience that they have taking those medications at home in an environment. Or your siblings or your, you know, other people who live in the house, nobody knows you take medicine. So where do you hide them? That barrier to trying to sneak away, or you want to go on a school trip, or you want to go and stay with friends and have a sleepover, or negotiating all of those issues around treatment, you know, can be incredibly hard. The newer medications that are fixed dose combinations of one pill once a day that are coloured to almost look like a vitamin pill do help, most definitely. But sometimes it's just about time, that understanding that as a healthcare professional or as a parent, you cannot force a young person to take medication. They have to choose this for themselves. And you have to wait, have an open conversation, be non-judgmental. There is absolutely no point telling people repeatedly they're going to die. They're quite aware of the facts behind their HIV. It's not that they don't want to live and that they don't want to take medication. It's just at that time in their life, they cannot do it. And for for that, they need support, not chastisement. Although I completely understand why parents of younger teenagers are getting incredibly anxious, and it's much easier to do it as a healthcare professional than a parent. I always say I don't shout at my patients, but gosh, I've shouted at my children. But, you know, it is, you know, people don't, you know, on the whole, they want to be well, but they're just struggling to complete that circle. And you have to find the motivation for change. And sometimes that is waiting and just holding your breath and keeping them well, keeping them accessing care so that if they have a low CD4 count and they get unwell, they access your care early so you can diagnose and you can treat and then start the conversation around medication. But you can't force people to do it. You have to work with them and find their motivation for behavioural change.
I think the only thing that I would add to all of what Caroline has just said is the need for children to be fully involved in their healthcare from a very young age, and with that involvement, understanding their HIV. And so we do have, not just in the UK, but globally, this is a shared experience, often a very long history of not telling young children that they have HIV for lots of complicated reasons that would warrant a podcast in their own right, I think, yeah, to explore. However, at the core of this is if you are asking a child to take medication, they need to understand why they're taking it. And then if you do that at a young age, you are empowering that child to understand their health, their body, and how the medicine is working. You know, none of us would want to take something without fully understanding why, what it's for, and having that explained in clear and accessible language when you're very young, but building that knowledge as you grow up. You know, in that consultation room, you are at the centre. I mean, we have so many stories of young people being told, you know, well, then suddenly I'm told to leave the room and the real conversation happens with my parents and I'm left outside wondering what they're talking about. Or they overhear snippets of conversations and they put things together in their mind and try and work out what's going on. And all these things add to an anxiety around medicine that you know, we would really do well to try and avoid at all costs. And I think empowering children and understanding their need for clear, accurate and truthful health information from a very young age is critical.
We sort of hear a lot around conversations that young people have around sort of struggling with medication or not having the best relationship with medication. And we've talked a lot about why that is, but what is there to sort of help manage this feeling? Or what advice would you give to anyone who is struggling to take their medication, how they would manage maybe the feeling of guilt of not taking it or just sort of managing the meds day to day?
I think for me, the real privilege of being able to work with young people and see them getting into their, you know, 24, 25, 26, 27, often those who've struggled in that period between 14 and 24. And about 20% of the young people I look after do struggle. And then suddenly 25, 26, they just start taking their medicines. And you ask them why, and they go, I have no idea. You know, they cannot pinpoint a certain event. It just sort of falls into place. You know, they just sort of, you know, grow up, you know, get older, or it just sort of clicks. You know, for some people, and that's the other thing about an individualized, you know, approach to healthcare. So I've had other young men who have really struggled with taking antiretrovirals for themselves. But when they've become sexually active and don't want to use condoms, they know they need to be undetectable for 6 months. And that's a huge motivator for them to be able to have normal relationships, not have to use condoms. And that is their motivator for change.
So I have one more question, which is, what is your most interesting sort of medical advancement you've seen over your years of HIV clinician care?
Gosh, I mean, there's a long list. But and to start with, going from, you know, very early on in my career, this new untreatable disease where, you know, 50% of the kids born with HIV died by their second birthday in sub-Saharan Africa. You know, it was absolutely devastating. I think more recently, however, the really unbelievably good news story about U equals U. So that's undetectable equals untransmittable. It means that if you've been on your medicines and your virus is asleep, HIV is asleep, you cannot transmit it to another person sexually. There is zero risk. And that doesn't matter what your sexuality is or what your sexual practices are. If you are undetectable on treatment, you cannot transmit your virus. And I was just chatting to a 14-year-old young man in clinic today. And we were talking about U equals U and undetectable equals untransmittable, but still talking about condom use to, you know, you don't want to be a baby father, you know, and you don't want to catch chlamydia. But it's not about you preventing yourself transmitting HIV. It's about shared relationships, shared contraception, and about you protecting yourself. It's a wonderful conversation to be able to have with those young people who are growing up now in their early adolescence, because it's very different to what we were able to say and the evidence we had.
Now it's time to check in with Ruth from Chiva, who's been speaking to our young people to share their thoughts on healthcare and treatment. What were the initial reactions to these clips that we just heard within the Chiva workshop group?
So, very mixed reactions. I think firstly, when it came to Agnes's clip, a lot of people empathised with her, saying that some of them agreed with how she felt and how accessibility was quite hard. So say this was some young people who have to travel quite far to go to their clinic. But then on the flip side, we had another young person who was very happy with their clinic experience because it's very close to them. It's faces that they recognise. And I think similar to what you're saying, Amanda, it's very important to make sure that all of these experiences are being heard, and very much that the young people who have great experiences, that's wonderful. But then the young people who have to travel far or don't see familiar faces, we really need to help them. And so I think we really found like there was a very big split in how accessible or even just how comfortable young people felt in their clinics, and how you guys were saying about the spring from the adolescent clinic to an adult clinic. That is a big jump, especially just emotionally for a young person. And so, yeah, a lot of the young people expressed how they really would want to be in a clinic that is comfortable, that they walk in happy to, that they're looking forward to their like appointments. And yeah, I think that was one thing that we found was really important to bring up. And the second one was when we were listening to Portia's clip, the biggest thing that came up was how she phrased life-saving medication. And I think that was a very big understanding of how there's a big difference in the UK and US medication. And I think for the US experience, especially Portia's, she didn't have that access to medication. So for her, it was life-saving. And whilst antiretrovirals are life-saving in the UK, I think a lot of the young people found having medication accessible to them was normal, was day-to-day. They always received this. It's not something that they have to fight for. It's something that is given to them so freely. And I think that's one thing that they found very humbling and very lucky to have. And I think that was great to hear their perspective, saying that medication should always be accessible no matter where you are. It should always be easy. It should always be open to be talking about no matter where you are, or in your family, in your friendship groups, in your schools. And so I think a lot of the young people felt very grateful that living in the UK meant they had easy medication, they had easy access, they had support groups, whether they went to them or not, that they had that choice. And I think that's one thing that they really found really important and wanted to bring up.
And you were in those discussion groups. Did you have any feedback on this?
I found it quite interesting how there was a complete split in both experiences of the young person living with HIV in the UK. And I think, yeah, similarly to what you said, Amanda, we should be really hearing out these young people who grew up in like hospital care as a child, but then lost interest in going to clinic, or lost almost the feeling of being welcomed, or they lost the idea of how not lucky they are to have medication, but just how easy it is for them to ask for help, because we do live in a place where it is quite easy to ask for help and get support. And so I think, yeah, the difference in the different young people's experience was something that I think was really key, and one thing I remember the most about that conversation.
I mean, I think it's really interesting, isn't it, that if you are born in the UK, and you are used to accessing free healthcare and having no stockouts of your antiretrovirals, and it's there for granted that you can access healthcare if you choose to, that your treatment and care will be free. And in many parts of the world, that is just not the case.
Yeah.
You know, and in terms of stockouts and in terms of the impact that COVID had on the access to testing, treatment, linkage to care, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, but also in Eastern Europe, for example, you know, we don't realise how privileged we are. And, you know, it's that constant fight for the NHS to continue that we want people to be able to access care, that those barriers to care that we think of here are actually much greater in many other parts of the world. You know, if you look at the States and actually, you know, having to access insurance programmes, etc., that, you know, they have another layer of barrier. Yeah, we could stop the epidemic completely if everybody had access to testing, linkage to care and to treatment. There doesn't have to be any but more babies born with HIV. There doesn't have to be any more adults infected. You know, and that possibility is enormous. But the practicalities of global, you know, global movement to make that happen is, you know, really complicated.
In the workshop, we spoke to some of the young people from Chiva, and they highlighted Portia's use of the word verticals, and that was used to describe someone born with HIV. And the young people agreed unanimously that it sounded very sci-fi, very spacey. But how important is the use of language around HIV, and how has this changed from generation to generation?
Oh, wow. That's a big question, Ruth. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Language is so important. I think we construct so much of the experience of, you know, HIV around the way we talk about it. And yeah, I'd not heard that term before either. Verticals, it sounds quite an unusual way of talking about children. But I mean, I get it. It makes sense. And I think it's just, the really important way in which language can either combat or contribute to ongoing stigma. And that's where we have to be really mindful, because sometimes we use terms and we don't even know we're contributing to a further stigmatizing of a particular issue. And it only takes a kind of stop, check, reflect. And in this instance, you know, still commonly this is referred to as mother-to-child transmission. But we know actually, and this is from asking people, this is from asking mothers, we know actually that can be quite difficult for mums to hear, because it really emphasises the transmission from the mother to the child. And some mothers have described that feeling, like that can be a bit of a kind of blaming around that terminology. So here, you know, the use of the term vertical might be to sort of try and remove some of that sense that there might be any blame involved. So it's so important to be really reflective. And all of our language use evolves over time, doesn't it? As we get better at understanding something and we check the way that something was kind of referred to previously, and we might not want to continue with that. And that's happened a lot with HIV, as it has with everything else.
Thanks for listening to the Positive Advice podcast. I'm Eli Fitzgerald, and my great thanks to Dr. Caroline Foster from St. Mary's Hospital in London, Amanda Ely, CEO of Chiva, and Ruth Mukko for joining me today. In our next episode, we're going back to school to look at education and HIV and adding to our oral history. If you want to learn more about Chiva, or if you want to access clips and updates from the Positively Spoken project, then head to chiva.org.uk and follow the links there. Positive Advice is a TBI media production for Chiva.